Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. The leader of the largest democracy in the world seems to have a low opinion of women. At an event in Bangladesh on Sunday, where he met Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi paid the following compliment to his counterpart. Quote, "I'm happy that Bangladesh's Prime Minister, despite being a woman, has declared zero tolerance for terrorism." The Twitterverse erupted in outrage on Monday with choice responses such as this one. Quote, "Managed to wake up and eat breakfast. Hashtag despite being a woman. And I can punch you in the face and make it look so ladylike. Hashtag despite being a woman." But Modi's problems run further than misogyny. During his first year in office, he has pushed land reform bills that opponents say target farmers and indigenous communities. During a visit to Europe earlier this year, Modi declared, quote, "India is open for business." My guest is Brinda Karat. She is a leading Indian politician with the Communist Party of India Marxist. She was the General Secretary of the All India Democratic Women's Association from 1993 to 2004. She continues today as its Vice President. She served as a Member of Parliament in 2005 and also became the first woman member of her party's top governing council, the Politburo. She is the author of Survival and Emancipation, Notes from Indian Women's Struggles, and I spoke with her yesterday in Santa Monica while she was visiting family members. So first, what do you make of Mr. Modi's interesting choice of words to describe Sheikh Hasina, the Prime Minister of Bangladesh?
Despite being a woman, hello, Mr. Modi, despite being a woman, I'm a human being. Despite being a woman, I have a brain. And despite being a woman, Sheikh Hasina has fought so hard to keep secular principles going in her country. She has taken on the fundamentalists. And I guess it's difficult for Mr. Modi to understand that, because Mr. Modi does belong to a stable of politics represented by the RSS, which is a very particular view of women, the best place for a woman being in the home. That's it.
And how do you think his views are being seen in an India that is increasingly, you know, paying attention to these things because of the media, and where he has made promises during his election campaign to be pro-woman?
Well, you know, as far as the media is concerned, the representation of something like this should have really, you know, triggered off an outrage. But I'm not sure whether that's happening right now. But as far as women are concerned, I think in the last 1 year, we have been confronted with a kind of fundamentalism which defines a woman's role in a very particular way. And as far as public money and allocations are concerned, the allocations for women's development has been cut so drastically that you see not just the coincidence, but you see the ideology being played out as far as public policy is concerned. And I think that is really the problem here. I mean, we have a system called the gender budget, in which you calculate how much of the allocation is going straight for women. And there has been a 20% cut in the first full budget given by the Modi government to the country. So this kind of reflects a downplaying of all that we have achieved, and also a reversal, in a sense, of many things that we have been demanding and we also achieved.
And so in the past couple of years, India has been in the international spotlight for a series of very high profile rapes and sexual assaults. Not to say that that wasn't happening before, but certain incidents got a lot of attention, and many Indians saw it as a sort of stain on India. I understand, just been this kind of internal struggle, but also a lot of dialogue. How, as a feminist, do you assess the national dialogue on gender, on feminism, and on sexual assault in the past couple of years in India?
I don't think it's a dialogue which has a homogeneity. I think, you know, there are different people with different approaches which are all coming into the dialogue. And I think one of the things that we do see is that the so-called women's issue has become a much more an issue which is also linked to basic rights of citizenship, of basic rights of democracy, a constitutional framework for the rights of women and the rights of women to security rather than an individual aspect of, you know, my security. Because if you look at it that way, then you always tend to go into a place where you're asked, so why were you there? Why were you walking in the street at night? Why were you with your boyfriend or with your partner, you know, at a late night show, etc.? So I think the framework for the discussion, women's movements have pushed it into a more gender-friendly space. But at the same time, you know, you have a politics ruling this country which really sees women seriously, you know, in a very restricted, confined role, and which would like to blame the victim for everything that's happening to her. And despite being a woman, what are you doing there at night? You know, this is the kind of approach, and it's serious. And I think more than the dialogue, it's also the dialogue in street actions. You know, it's the mobilization of a much larger number of Indians, men and women, which came out after the terrible Nirbhaya case in December of 2013. So I think that is one of the aspects that, you know, it's positive in the sense that people are fighting back. But, you know, there doesn't really seem to be very much of an impact as far as the number of cases are concerned. In fact, we are seeing a very, very disturbing increase in the kind of violence. It's sexual assault, it's also domestic violence. And I think it is one of the greatest challenges that India faces.
And the Modi government, in speaking out, or in fact, even during the election campaign, before the election of the BJP, made a lot of promises. I think, of course, riding this wave of frustration felt by the public. So what specifically did he promise? And I know it's only been a year, might be not enough time to deliver, but had he made specific promises, and has he even begun to deliver on them, on the issue of gender justice?
You see, the issue really is what you consider gender justice. You know, if you don't consider giving women jobs and equal wages and labor protections as gender justice, what do you consider gender justice? So the issue really is so deeply linked with the whole ideological framework in which the Modi government is operating. Now, for example, as I was saying, look at just work days for women. They have gone down drastically in rural India. Now, how do you empower a poor rural woman unless you can ensure that she gets decent work and she gets a decent wage, she gets an equal wage? How can you ensure that unless you give a woman equal right to assets? For example, land, but you're taking away everybody's land for the corporate. So where does a woman fit in there? So the point really is that, and even if you just look at it from the angle of violence, you know, we set up, you know, we have something called the Nirbhaya Fund, which was set up after the victim of that terrible gang rape in Delhi. And there's a lot of money sitting in that fund, but there is not a single scheme. In fact, the Women and Child Minister for Women and Child Affairs in India has been complaining that she wants to set up crisis centers for rape survivors so that they can go to a place right away at the district level. But the Modi government has said, we don't have the money for it. But they have the money, they don't have the money for it. So they're saying, we're going to have it only at the state level. So, it, you know, when you come to the nitty-gritty of it and look at the small detail, you know, Modi talks big, but unfortunately, it's really not playing out on the ground.
So you mentioned land, and that's a big issue in India. It's an agricultural economy, but it's also a densely populated country, so land is premium. And Modi has promised land reforms. He has opened up, thrown out the welcome mat, ideologically at least, and metaphorically to the world, saying India is open for business. What are some of the land reforms that he has put forth? I understand you were at a meeting recently that was reported in the press where you said the parliament has turned into a gang of capitalists, or at least that's what was reported. So what are they doing with land reform in India?
Well, what I actually said was that Parliament is, you know, now becoming a house of corporates and corporate representatives. And that is something really disturbing in Indian politics, because you are deciding laws for a country which still has the highest number of malnourished people in the world, which is what the most recent FAO report has said. We have and a lot of them are dependent on land. They are small farmers. unless you have investment into the small farm economies in India, and unless you provide viable alternatives, if you want them to move out and to have, you know, a better opportunities of employment, instead of which this is basically a land grab ordinance which Modi is bringing in. And this land grab ordinance allows corporates to take over land, including fertile land, without the consent of farmers. Now, this is not making India easy for business. This is making India a hellhole for the largest number of people who are farmers. So our point is, yes, industrialization is important, but you cannot have industrialization on the graves of India's farmers. This is not 18th century and 19th century capitalism just running riot. This is a democracy. India, you know, you claim India to be the most developing, fastest developing country. You show the growth rates, and yet you have, in the last 1 year, a 26% increase in farmer suicides because of distress. So these are things which Modi, it's not land reform, it's land grab.
And he has promised something that, you know, sounds really fascinating and wonderful on paper, which is 100 new smart cities. Modi seems very taken by technology, and the cult of personality that's grown up around him has also been based a little bit of that on that. What are these smart cities that he's promising?
It's maximum propaganda and minimum performance, to tell you the truth. Nobody knows. What is he actually talking about, except giving real estate corporates a huge opportunity to grab land? What smart cities? Let's make Delhi a smart city. Delhi has the largest, most terrible slums. Delhi has a population which is highly undernourished. Let's make the city of Delhi, the capital of India, start with that. How can you have a smart city where you have this huge population of poor people? I mean, I think it would be smart if you started talking about socially relevant policies which would help people to make smart choices about their lives.
And so the bullet trains that he has promised won't ease poverty?
Really, what can I say about that? I mean, in fact, what's happening really is the Indian Railways has played historically, as you know, a very important role in, you know, in helping development. But what's happening now is the Indian Railways is being privatized. For the first time, they're allowing private industry to come into Indian Railways. And we know what happened in Britain, for example. We know what's happened in many other countries where public transport has been replaced by privatization, which has led to... And railways is the one mode of transport for millions of people all across India who travel to their places of work. Now, if you're going to privatize the railways and if you're going to have bullet trains, which are going to be so expensive, who's going to ride in them? So the question really is the obscene inequalities in India. And for Modi, that is not the priority. So you have all these huge schemes in an ocean of increasing poverty and inequality. I don't think that's the way to take India forward.
What about the role of the main opposition party, which is a role that the Congress Party is now playing? The Congress Party, which has for years sort of been the main party in power in India, and it seems to be a convenient ploy right now to see, to have the BJP against which the Congress can play the progressive party. Is that what's happening?
Absolutely. I don't know if anybody sees it as progressive, but certainly the positioning is there. I mean, frankly, it's quite a joke when, you know, Mr. Rahul Gandhi starts saying that, you know, you are Suit Boot Sarkar. I mean, what was his Sarkar for, you know, since the 1990s? Suit Boot meaning a suited, booted government, you know, representing the corpus. But, I mean, Modi's policies, in fact, are really a takeover of the Congress policies, except that he can be much more aggressive because he has the numbers in Parliament and the Congress didn't. Mm-hmm. So that's the only difference. But there's not a jot of difference in their economic policies. So when you hear Mr. Rahul Gandhi speaking that kind of language, you think, well, I mean, forget it. In this day and age, all you need to have is two statements of what he's saying now and what he said 5 years ago.
Do you think that not just the Congress, but certainly now the BJP are playing to and have often played to India's educated middle class when they talk, for example, about wanting to cut red tape and bureaucracy, which the middle class is very frustrated with because it's harder for them to get things done. When they talk about the Make It in India campaign, you know, bringing manufacturing jobs to India instead of importing things from outside, it seems as though that plays well to the minority of Indians that are middle class and educated.
Well, I think manufacturing is critical, and I think Make in India, the way that Modi is positioning it, is to do away with all labor laws, so as to make in India, and make in India, which basically, you know, demeaned slave labor.
So turn India into China.
Well, you know, China at least had some protection for its workers, but today, even the RBI governor has said that you cannot have Make in India on the basis of a world economy where your exports are coming down. So you make manufacture in India and sell outside, but the world economy is not accepting that kind of model 20 or 30 years after it worked in China. So what the RBI governor has also suggested is expand the domestic market. But to expand the domestic market, you need to put government money in public infrastructure, in industry, so as to trigger off a manufacturing boost to provide employment. So if you have more money in people's hands in India and you have a domestic economy which is much better than it is right now, where there's so much inequality, you will have Make in India, Made in India, Sell in India. You can't just have Make, you have to have Sell in India because you have the largest population. For example, the latest consumption expenditure figures right now, it shows that there's a decline over the last year. So there's no demand. There's no demand because, you know, you don't have money in your pocket. So I think manufacturing is important. Industry is important. But the way that Mr. Modi thinks of bringing in FDI by, you know, demeaning your own workers, having cheap labor as your biggest offering to world capital, it's not going to work.
I mean, Indian labor is already quite exploited.
Do you know, out of every 100 rupees of a cost of a factory, just 2 rupees 17 paisa is the cost, the wage cost. So it's so low already. So where do you want to push it down, you know? So
what about the fact that the Indian left, of which your party, the CPIM, represents a strong part, what sort of role does the CPIM and other left parties play? And there was a time when there seemed as though there was more power in the hands of left parties, and that's a sort of come and gone.
That's true. We have suffered a big electoral setback in the last 5 years, even in the last Lok Sabha elections. So our numbers in parliament are down. So certainly that does affect your intervention as far as parliament is concerned, as far as preventing the kind of laws which Modi wants to push. 50 laws he wants to push without parliamentary scrutiny. And of course, if the left had a bigger presence in parliament, we would have been able to fight that in a much stronger way. However, I think that right now what India needs is a movement based on alternative politics. And I think that is where the CPIM and the left has to come out much more strongly in a more united way. Because, you know, here you have, it's not really BJP versus Congress as far as economics is concerned, because they're both on the same side. So basically to have an understanding of alternative politics, I think the fulcrum has to be United Left. And I think that's what we're working on right now. You know, wider platform of left forces, of left and democratic-minded citizens, not necessarily in political parties, just individuals, groups, organizations, movements, and that kind of a coming together. You know, social alliances, I think, is very, very critical. And our recent party conference, our national party conference, has decided on this approach for our intervention. And I hope that that's going to help us to increase the resistance.
And how do you explain the electoral defeats? And also, does that have anything to do with the rise of a new party on the scene, the Aam Aadmi Party, which many have made much of? It's not clear necessarily whether they have an ideological platform beyond ending corruption, etc.
No, not at all. The AAP has just 4 members in parliament, and that also from a single state. So I don't think that's anything to do with it. It's more to do with the loss of our base in West Bengal. You know, because our representation parliament was mainly from the 3 states of Kerala, West Bengal, and Tripura. So while we have, you know, maintained our position in Kerala, just with a few ups and downs, basically it is in West Bengal that we lost our electoral presence. And we have faced a setback there. But I think over the last year or two, the resistance in Bengal has grown. And I think, I hope that with our own corrections of our own weaknesses and with, you know, the kind of all-in unity that there was against, you know, the most important left-run government in India, which was in Bengal. So there was a range of forces against us. And, you know, that unity worked to isolate us from the people. And I think we are overcoming that at the grassroots level. And I'm confident that in the coming days and months and years, you will see a resurgence of the left in Bengal.
Is there an influencing of youth in ideologies such as communism, socialism? Is communism and socialism relevant to young Indians today?
I think there are young Indians and young Indians. So I think, you know, we do find that a large, large communities of young people in rural India, among Adivasis, among scheduled castes, are among the working class, are attracted to the left. But yes, it's a fact that, you know, in the urban areas, you know, the young, educated, university-going students, the kind of mobilizations that we saw in the 70s, 80s, are not there. And I think that is also very much to do with the monopolies in the media and the monopolies in communication today, you know, this whole assault on reality following the collapse of the Soviet Union and socialism is a dead letter and so on, you know, there's nothing but capitalism. You know, that did have a very big impact worldwide ideologically. But we do find, for example, in many areas in Europe, you know, we see in Greece, we see in Portugal, we see in many areas in Europe and even in American campuses, we see a bigger interest in left ideology, in Marxism. Latin America, of course. I mean, Latin America has, you know, led the resistance to neoliberal policies, and they have provided sustainable alternatives. But it has had an impact. And it is a struggle.
So when you were saying,
I don't want to underestimate, you know, the setback that we've had ideologically worldwide. But, you know, there's a logic to the fight back. Because look at where capitalism is landing the world today. I mean, does capitalism have any answers morally, ethically, economically, politically, except to give more and more power to the 1%? I mean, let's face it, it does not have the answers. Socialism does. But I think every country has to work out its own way of reaching that socialist goal.
So on the issue of the media, which is an interesting question, Indian media companies have just boomed in the last few years, but also multinational conglomerates have taken over much of the media landscape in India as well. And you see a very different landscape on television, for example, today than you did before. At the same time, the rise of internet media and social media and peer-to-peer communications has risen remarkably, where people are able to communicate with one another and with people around the world like never before. How do you see those sort of twin forces impacting the way people think and the future of the left in India?
Well, I believe that, you know, there are certainly different tracks available today as far as communication is concerned. But I am really concerned that the net and the whole issue today of net neutrality really presages the intervention of corporates and big money into what was considered free media and free communication. So if you're not going to have free access to a media of your choice, even on internet, you're going to see the same patterns of corporate takeover of communication that you're seeing in the mainstream news channels. I mean, it is just shocking and sickening and disgusting that, you know, the money that's put in, and, you know, we have something called paid news, you know. It's literally, I mean, of course, you have the more obvious parts of it where you're buying advertisement time and you're buying out journalists, so on. That's obvious. But frankly, paid news is so much a part of the corporate takeover of the whole world, frankly, that, you know, you just have to be so clear and rooted. And young people and people who get their news from, you know, watching interpretations on TV channels, you cannot imagine what it was during the Lok Sabha elections in India. I mean, nobody had a chance because there was a corporate support, a united, strong corporate backing of Mr. Modi as Prime Minister. And the main media channels in India were totally with it. So that's, you saw live wall-to-wall coverage of every statement he made, every speech he made. You know, it was just the most amazing thing. They said, oh, well, this is like the American presidential elections. And I said, well, God help India.
So, I mean, and that's what Chomsky called manufacturing consent.
Yeah, absolutely, years ago. And, you know, and we're seeing it now in so many diverse ways. And I think that is really, if they are allowed to take over internet, which is really a big struggle which is going on right now, you know, you deep pockets and independent channels don't go together. And I think the very fact that independent channels such as yours exist is also because there is such a need. You know, people feel the need for it more and more. They want less noise and more news.
So finally, I'm wondering if you think the fact that Mr. Modi has made such vast promises to the Indian people, that the good days are coming, that he has made such exuberant pledges that, you know, a year later, he's not able to put forward. He may not even have enough votes in the upper house of parliament to push forward some of his reforms. Is there a risk that that exuberance might fade, that people would start, the vast majority of people who might have drunk the Kool-Aid might start to see through it?
As far as Mr. Modi is concerned, it's certainly a concern. As far as we are concerned, that's what we're working for. Because what we have seen, and I agree with you, that, you know, 1 year is not, you know, you cannot really come. But you can certainly see the direction a government is going to take. And this is really, you know, so pro-corporate and backed by, you know, forces of sectarian strife. You know, you have this whole part of communalization of politics where religion becomes an instrument of really sectarian mobilization targeting minorities. Now, that is the greatest concern for India today. And I think a combination of corporates and the sectarian mobilization based on religion targeting minorities, that is really a very big challenge which has emerged in the last year, because you have a prime minister who is openly committed to the RSS view of so-called Hindutva in India. And I think that's not India.
Yeah, and in fact, let's squeeze in one last question on that, because it is a big question. The fact that this man himself personally has been implicated in the horrific genocidal communal violence, but also his party has fomented and whipped up religious fervor and Hindu supremacy. He's keeping that, or trying to keep that, under wraps, or has some of that seeped out in the past year?
Well, you have his members of parliament in his presence making the most outrageously anti-minority, anti-constitutional, provocative statements, and he sat there in silence. His silence has been deafening on this. And this is the two-track politics, that you speak something, you say, you know, we're going to take everybody with us. And then at the grassroots level, you are giving full rein and support to the RSS to have direct access to power. And I think that is the story of Mr. Modi's success. You still have the RSS working hard to divide India, and you have a prime minister who believes in that, and he defends that by his silence.
I would love to talk to you again in a couple of years and see where Mr. Modi is headed. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure. And may I congratulate you on your channel and your own programs.
Thank you so much. Such an honor. Thank you. My guest, Brinda Karat, is a leading Indian politician with the Communist Party of India, Marxist. She was a general secretary of the All India Democratic Women's Association from 1993 to 2004. She continues today as its vice president. She served as a member of parliament in 2005 and also became the first woman member of her party's top governing council, the Politburo. She is the author of Survival and Emancipation, Notes from Indian Women's Struggles, and I spoke with her yesterday in Santa Monica during a family visit.